You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Becoming the Archangel Michael's Companions, Rudolf Steiner's Challenge to the Younger Generation. This is Lecture 10, given in Stuttgart on October 12th. 1922. Yesterday I wanted to show how we must come to an education steeped in artistic form. I drew attention to how, in earlier times, teachers took their start from the artistic in higher education, by treating as arts what today has become entirely abstract and scientific, namely grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. This was done in such a way that young people first recognized in their teacher, this human being can do something that I cannot do. And through this alone, the right relationship was established between the younger and the older generations. For this relationship, my dear friends, can never develop along the path of intellectuality. As soon as one works with the intellect, ideas are no longer inwardly revealed in the intellectual or mind-soul, and there is no possibility of differentiating between human beings. For human nature is so constituted that when it is a matter of making something clear through the consciousness soul, when people come only to concepts, they believe they can discuss them with anyone. Thus it is with the intellect. For the intellect, neither human maturity nor experience comes into consideration. Maturity and experience only do so when it is a question of ability. The ability of an older person will be recognized and accepted by the young quite as a matter of course. Now, in order to understand these things thoroughly, we must consider, from a different point of view, the course taken by humankind's evolution with regard to the interaction between human beings. External documentary history can go back only a few thousand years before the mystery of Golgotha, and what is to be found can never be estimated rightly, because even the spiritual achievements of ancient Greece cannot be grasped by modern concepts. Even for the old Grecian times, completely different concepts must be used. Nietzsche, among others, felt this. Hence the charm of his brief unfinished essay on in my attempt to German, Die Philosophie im tragischen Zeitalter der Griechen, Philosophy in the Tragic Age of the Greeks, where he deals with philosophy in connection with the general development of Greek culture up to the time of Socrates. In Socrates he saw the first flicker of pure intellectuality, while everything philosophical in the Tragic Age of Greek development proceeded from comprehensive human foundations or depths. When these are expressed in concepts, we must note that concepts are a language through which only what is experienced can be conveyed. In the earliest times, philosophy was quite different from what it later became, but I only want to point this out. What I really want to speak about is that with spiritual imagination, and especially with inspiration, we can look back much further into human evolution, and above all into human souls. When we go very far back, some 7 or 8 thousand years before the mystery of Golgotha, we find that the young had a natural veneration for old age. Why was this a matter of course? It is because what exists today only in the earliest youth existed then for the whole evolution of humanity. If we look at the human being with less superficiality than is often done today, we find that the whole evolution of the human soul changes at about the time of the change of teeth, during the 6th, 7th, or 8th year. Human souls become different, and they change again at the time of puberty. I discussed this fully in my book titled The Education of the Child. Briefly, it is noticed that souls become different in the 7th year, and again in the 14th or 15th. But what people no longer notice is that changes still take place at the beginning of the 20s, at the end of the 20s, in the middle of the 30s, and so on. Whoever is able to observe the life of soul in a more intimate way knows that such transitions take place in human beings, that human life runs its course in rhythms. Try to perceive this, let us say, in Goethe. Goethe records how he was cured of certain childlike religious ideas by the Lisbon earthquake, thus about the time of the change of his teeth, and how puzzling everything was for him. He tells how, as a small child, he began to reflect, "Is there a good God ruling the world?" when one sees that countless people have been swept away through these terrible fiery forces in the earth. Especially during such transitional moments of his life, Goethe was susceptible to the influences of external events working upon his soul, such as to be conscious of the transformation of his soul. And he says concerning this period of his life that he became a strange kind of pantheist, and that he could no longer believe in the ideas imparted by the older people in his home and by his parents. He tells how he took his father's music stand, on which he set out minerals, placing on top a little candle that he lit by holding a burning glass to catch the first rays of the morning sun. In later life he explained that he had wanted to make an offering to the great God of nature by lighting a sacrificial fire kindled on nature herself. Take the first period of Goethe's life, then the following one, and so on, until you piece together his whole life out of segments of about the length of his first period of childhood. And you will find that with Goethe something always happened in each of these periods to change his soul thoroughly. It is extraordinarily interesting to see that the fact of Schiller's urging Goethe to continue Faust only found fruitful soil in Goethe because, at the end of the 18th century, he happened to be at a transitional period of this kind. It is interesting, too, that Goethe rewrote Faust at the beginning of a following life period. Goethe wrote the beginning of Faust in his youth in such a way that he makes Faust open the book of Nostradamus. There we have the great scene, quote, "What powers celestial, lo, ascend, descend, each unto each the golden vessels giving." Then turn the page, and there we find, quote, "Thou spirit of the earth, to me art nearer." Close quote. Goethe rejects the great tableau of the macrocosm, and allows only the earth spirit to approach Faust. When, at the beginning of the 19th century, he was persuaded by Schiller to revise Faust, he wrote the Prologue in Heaven. Anyone who observes his own life inwardly will discover that these changes hold good. Nowadays, we only notice them when we deliberately train ourselves to look deeply into our own life. In ancient times, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years before the mystery of Golgotha, these changes were so noticeable that they were experienced in the life of soul like the change of teeth or puberty is today. And indeed, approximately up to the middle of life, up to the 35th or 36th year, life was experienced as ascending. But then it began to decline. Human beings experienced the drying up of life. Yet, while they felt certain products of metabolism become deposited through sluggishness in the organism, and the physical organism become increasingly heavy and lethargic, they became aware that at the same time, up to the greatest age, precisely the soul and spirit were on the ascent. They felt how the soul is set free with the drying up of the body. And people in olden days would not have spoken with such ardor of the patriarchs, the word itself only arose later, had they not noticed externally in people, true, they are getting physically old, but they have to thank their physical aging for lighting up the spirit. They are no longer dependent on the body. The body withers, the soul becomes free. In this modern age, it is most unusual that such a thing happens, for instance, as occurred at the Berlin University. Two philosophers were there. The one was Zeller, the famous Greek scholar, and the other was Michelet. Zeller was 70 years old and wanted to retire. Michelet was 90 and lectured with tremendous vivacity. Edward von Hartmann told me that Michelet is supposed to have said, I do not understand why that young man does not want to lecture any more. Today people seldom keep their freshness to such a degree. However, in those times it was so, especially among those who devoted themselves to true spiritual life. What did the young say when they looked at the patriarchs? They said, "It is beautiful to get old." For then one learns something through one's own development that one cannot know before. It was perfectly natural to speak in this way. Just as a little boy with a toy horse wants to be big and get a real horse, so that at that time there was the desire to get old, because it was felt that something is then revealed from within. Then came the following millennia. It was still experienced up to a considerable age, but not any more as long as was the case in the old Indian epoch, according to the terminology of my title Esoteric Science. At the zenith of Greek culture, human beings still had a vivid experience of the change occurring in life in the middle of the 30s. People still knew how to distinguish between body and spirit and said, at the age of 30, the physical begins to decline, but then the spiritual begins to sprout. They experienced this in the soul and spirit in the immediate presence of human beings. The original feeling of the Greeks was based upon this, not upon that fantasy of which modern science speaks. To understand the fullness of Greek culture, we should bear in mind that the Greeks could still be conscious of becoming 30, 35, 36 years old, whereas a more ancient humanity was conscious of their aging up to a far greater age. Herein consists the evolution of humanity. Then humanity had by nature to experience aging more and more unconsciously. Now the call arises to experience it consciously, for it must again be experienced consciously. Whoever observes their own lives can recognize the seven-year changes. The length of these periods is not pedantically exact, but approximate. Those who look back to the period of their 49th, 42nd, 35th years can recognize quite well. At that time something happened in me through which I learned something that I could not have attained before out of my own nature, just as I would not have been able to bite with my second teeth before I had them. The ability to experience life as something concrete has been lost in the course of human evolution. And if people today do not inwardly train themselves to observe these things in themselves, these epochs from the 30th year onward will become completely blurred. An inner transformation can still be noticed at the beginning of the 20s, even up to the end of the 20s, though it is then rather less noticeable. However, today, with the present human organization, human beings are carried by their natural evolution actually only up to their 26th or 27th year, and this age limit will become lower and lower. In earlier times, people were not free in their organization, destined as they were to have these experiences out of their own nature. Freedom has become possible only by the withdrawal of the determining by nature. To the extent that nature ceases to determine us, freedom becomes possible. Through their own striving, human beings must find the spiritual, whereas formerly the older human beings became, from year to year, the more the spiritual sprouted forth naturally. Today, emphasis is no longer placed on what the old become merely by growing older. Human beings stopped in their development with that intellectualism which is developed between the 18th and 19th years, to the point that from then onward one can know with the intellect. But as far as intellectuality is concerned, one can at most reach a greater degree of proficiency, but can make no qualitative progress. If one has fallen victim to the desire to prove or to refute everything intellectually, one cannot progress. That is why if someone puts forward what is the result of decades of experience, but wants to prove it intellectually, an 18-year-old can refute it intellectually. For whatever is possible intellectually at 60 years of age is equally possible at 19. Intellectuality is a stage reached during the consciousness soul that brings no further progress in the sense of deepening, but only in proficiency. The young may say, quote, "We are not yet as clever as you are. You can still take us in," close quote. But they will not believe the other to be their superior in the sphere of intellect. These things must be expressed radically to make them clear. I do not wish to criticize, but am only showing what a natural evolution of humanity is. We must be clear about the following characteristic of our age, namely, that if human beings today do not strive out of inner activity for development and maintain it consciously, they will rust with mere intellectualism from their 20th year on. They will keep themselves going only through stimuli from outside. Do you think that if things were not like that, people would flock to the cinema so much? This longing for the cinema, this longing to see everything externally, is caused by the human beings becoming inwardly inactive, by their no longer wanting inner activity. The only way spiritual scientific lectures, as they are meant here, can be heard is for those present to work continually along with the speaker. But today that is not to people's liking. They flock to meetings or lectures with slides so that they can sit and do as little thinking as possible. Everything just passes before them. They can remain perfectly passive. But our system of teaching is ultimately of this character too, and anyone who, on educational grounds, objects to the triviality of a modern object lesson is said to be behind the times. But one has to oppose it, for humanity is not a mere apparatus for observing, an apparatus that wants simply to look at things. Humans can live only by inner activity. To bring or express something out of spiritual science means to invite human beings to work along with you with their souls. People do not want this today. Spiritual science must become such an invitation to interactivity, that is to say, it must lead all studies to the point where there is no more support in external sense perception, and the inner play of forces must move freely. Imagination cannot be reached before thinking moves freely in this inner play of forces. Thus the basis for all anthroposophy is inner activity, the challenge to inner activity, the appeal to what can be active when all the senses are silent and only the activity of thinking is astir. Here is something of extraordinary significance. Just suppose you were capable of this. I will not flatter you by saying that you are. Assume that you are capable of it, that you can think in such a way that your thoughts are only an inner flow of thoughts. What I call pure thinking in my title, Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, also called the Philosophy of Freedom, was certainly not well named when judged by outer cultural conditions. For Edward von Hartmann said to me, quote, "There is no such thing. One can only think with the aid of external observation," close quote. And all I could say in reply was, quote, "One only has to try it, and one will learn and finally be able really to do it," close quote. Thus, take it as an hypothesis that you could have thoughts in a flow of pure thought. And then there begins for you the moment when you have had led thinking to a point where it need not be called thinking any longer, because in a twinkling, in the twinkling of a thought, it has become something different. This rightly named pure thinking has become pure will, for it is willing through and through. And if you have advanced so far in your life of soul that you have freed thinking from outer perception, it has become at the same time pure will. You hover with your soul, so to speak, in a pure course of thought. But this pure course of thought is a course of will. The pure thinking, or the striving for the practicing of pure thought, begins to be not only a thought exercise, but also a will exercise, and indeed such a will exercise that works right into the center of the human being. For you will make the following remarkable observation. It is only now, for the first time, that you can speak of thinking, as it is in ordinary life, as an activity of the head. Before this, you really have no right to speak of thinking as an activity of the head, for you know this only as external fact from physiology, anatomy, and so on. But now you feel inwardly that you are no longer thinking so high up. You begin for the first time to think with the heart. You actually interweave your thought with the breathing process. You actually set going what the yoga exercises have striven for artificially. You notice that as thinking becomes more and more an activity of the will, it wrenches itself free first from the breast and then from the whole human body. It is as though you were to draw forth this thinking from the last fiber of your big toe. And if with inner participation you study what has happened with many imperfections, for I make no claims about my intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, if you let it work upon you and feel what this pure thinking is, you will experience that a new person is born within you, who can bring out of the spirit an unfolding of the will. How do humans know that they have a will otherwise? They do not have will, for they are given up to instincts connected with their organic development. They often dream that they do this or that out of an impulse of the soul, but they really do it because of the good or bad condition of their stomachs. But now you know that you have permeated the physical organism with what fills it with consciousness. You do not need to be a clairvoyant for this. All you need do is to be interested in intuitive thinking as a spiritual path and let it work upon you. For intuitive thinking as a spiritual path cannot be read as other books are today. It must really be read so that once you get into intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, you have the feeling that it is an organism with one member developing out of another, that you feel that you have found your way into something living. When such a thing is asked of people, their skin begins immediately to crawl, and they say, "Something is going to get into me which will take away my freedom. Something will enter me that I do not want to have." That is no different than if one were to maintain that we would be unfree if we had to accustom ourselves to speaking a certain language in 2 or 3 years. Human beings ought to be warned against language, for they will no longer be free when brought into this chance association of ideas. They ought to be able to speak at will, now Chinese, now French, now German. No one says this, because it would be too absurd, and life itself refutes such nonsense. On the other hand, there are people who either hear or see something of eurythmy and say that it is based on the chance association of the ideas of individuals. But one should be able to expect that philosophers would say, "One must look into this eurythmy and see if in evoking gestures we may not have the foundations of a higher freedom, and find that it is only an unfolding of speech at a higher level." So one need not be surprised, for really nothing that goes beyond intellectualism can be regarded without prejudice today, that people get goose flesh when one tells them that a certain book must be read quite differently from other books, that it must be read in such a way that one really experiences something from it. What is it that must be experienced? It is the awakening of the will out of the spiritual. In this respect, my book was intended as a means of education or training. The intention was not merely to communicate content, but to make it work educationally. Hence you find in my intuitive thinking as a spiritual path an exposition on the art of forming concepts, a description of what takes place in the soul when one does not keep to the impressions from outside with one's concepts, but lives within the free flow of thoughts. This, my dear friends, is an activity that aims at knowledge in a far deeper sense than the external knowledge of nature. But it is at the same time artistic, wholly identical with artistic activity. In that moment when pure thinking is experienced as will, human disposition becomes artistic. And this artistic disposition is what teachers need today to guide and lead the young from the time of the change of teeth to puberty, or even beyond puberty. The mood of soul should be so that out of the inner life of soul one comes to a second human being, who cannot be known in the same way as is the outer physical body, which can be studied physiologically or anatomically, but who must be livingly experienced and may rightly be called, in accordance with the real meaning of the terms, life body or ether body. This ether body cannot be known through external perception, but must be experienced inwardly. To know this second human being, a kind of artistic activity must be developed. Hence there is this mood in intuitive thinking as a spiritual path that most people never discover. Everywhere it touches the artistic element. Most people do not notice this, because they look for the artistic and the trivial in the naturalistic, and not in free activity. Only out of this free activity can education really be experienced as art, and teachers can become artists in education when they find their way into this mood. Then in our epoch of the consciousness soul, all teaching will be so arranged as to create an artistic atmosphere between teacher and pupil. And within this artistic atmosphere, there can develop a relationship between those being led and the leaders that is an inclining towards the leader, because they can do something and are able to show it forth artistically. And one feels that what they can do, one would also like to be able to do. Thus, no opposition is aroused, because it is felt that one would destroy oneself by opposing. The way writing is taught today, it often happens that even as a child, for in the child there is always a being who is cleverer than the teacher, one asks, why should I be bothered to write? I have no relationship to writing. Something similar is really what the Native Americans felt when they saw European script. They felt the black signs to be magic. The feeling of the child is often similar. But let us awaken in the child what it means to look at black, red, green, yellow, white. Let us call up in the child what it is when we surround a point by a circle. Let us call up the great experience contained in the difference there is when we draw two green circles and in each of them three red circles, then two red and in each of them three green, two yellow with three blues in them, then two blue containing three yellow circles. We let the children experience in the colors what the colors as such are saying to the human being. For in the colors there lives a whole world. But we also let the children experience what the colors have to say to one another, what green says to red, what blue says to yellow, blue to green and red to blue. Here we have the most wonderful relation between the colors. We do not show the child symbols or allegories, but we do something artistically. Then we shall see how, out of this artistic feeling, the child gradually puts down figures, out of which the letters then develop, just as writing once developed from picture script. How foreign to the child today are B, G, or any other sign that has developed through inner necessity to its present form. What is a G, K, or U to a 7-year-old today? The child really has not the slightest kinship with it. It has taken the human being thousands of years to acquire this relationship. The child must acquire a relation to it in an aesthetic way. Everything is exterminated in the child because the written characters are not human, and the child wants to remain human. In order to understand youth in its relation to the older generation, we must go right into the art of education. The cleft between age and youth must be bridged, not by hollow phrases, but by education that is an art, education that is not afraid to find its support in real spiritual scientific knowledge. That is why I said a few days ago, where does this art lead? It leads to the experience of the real spiritual. And where does it lead that the age has gradually developed in such a way that it believes it must be given as a matter of course to the young? It does not lead to the spirit, but to what is devoid of spirit. It is regarded as a sin to bring the spirit into what one calls knowledge and science. Science does not leave the human being alone even in earliest childhood. It cannot very well be otherwise, for the teachers are so drilled in systematized botany, and many books are entirely given over to systematized botany, that they believe they are committing a sin if they speak to the children about botany in a way that is not scientific. But what is found in a botanical textbook is not appropriate for a child before the age of 10. And it is not even excuse me, and it is not until at least 18 or 19 that one can develop any real relationship to it. What I have said should not bring about another intellectual theory about education. The aim is to create an artistic atmosphere between the older and the younger people. Only when this comes about does something happen that must occur if young people are to grow into the world in a healthy way. What the human being of today grows into can be described quite concretely. Between the 9th and 10th years are an undefined feeling lives in the soul of every human being who is not a psychopath. There need not necessarily exist either a clear or unclear concept of this. But it begins to live within the human being from the 9th or 10th year. Up until then, the astral body alone took care of the life of the soul. However, from that time onward, the force of the capital I nature first begins to stir in the human being. It is not formulated in concepts, but in the life of feeling deep within the soul, there lives unconsciously a question in the heart of the growing human being. This question takes different forms in different people. But a question arises that, put in the form of a concept, might be expressed as follows. Up to now, the astral body has believed in other human beings. Now I need something that somebody says to me so that I may believe in this person or in others in my surroundings. Those who, as children, have resisted this the most are those who need it most. Between the 9th and 10th years, human beings begin to be dependent on an older person in whom they can believe in order to strengthen their I. They must be able to believe in this human being without this trust needing to be drummed in, but rather through the artistic atmosphere that has been created. And what great sorrow when nothing happens from the side of an older person to answer rightly this question, which may still remain for many children up to their 16th or 17th year, and for some even to the 18th or 19th year, so that the young say, I am grateful that I have learned from the old what I can learn only from the old. What this person can tell me, he or she alone can tell me, for it will be different if I learn it when I am old. Through this, something can be created in an educational way, which, applied in the right way, can be of the greatest significance for the epoch of the consciousness soul, something which, in fact, was already alive between young and old in the earliest times of the patriarchs. At that time, all young people said to themselves, the old people, with their snow-white hair, have experiences that can only come when one is as old as they are. Before then, one does not have the necessary organs for it. Therefore, the old must tell their experiences to us. We are dependent on what they relate because they alone can relate it. Certainly I shall one day be as old as they are, but I shall only experience what they can tell in 35 or 40 years. The times will have progressed by then, and I shall experience something different. In the foundations of the spirit life of the world, there is, so to speak, a chain that reaches from the past over into the future, and which each generation must take up and carry onward, forge, and perfect. This chain has been broken in the age of intellectualism. This was generally felt among those growing up about the turn of the 19th century to the 20th. Try to feel that you did experience something of the kind, even if at that time you were not able to express it. Try to sense that with feeling this, you were feeling about it in the right way. And if you sense this, you will realize the true significance of the youth movement today. The youth movement which has and must have a Janus head, because it is directed toward experience of the spiritual, an experience of the spiritual that carries thought so far it becomes will, it becomes the innermost human impulse. We have been seeking now for will at its abstract pole, where it is thought. In the days to follow, we will seek it in the deeper spheres of the human being. End of Lecture 10.